Hi, I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori. We've always thought that the most compelling story strikes the perfect balance between an honest look at the mess of life and the humor that can be found in the mess. To be perfectly honest, we don't really know how to live life without both the humor and the authenticity.
Our podcast might be a little bit of whiplash at times. We can spin from hard and deep to humor and laughing on a dime. The hard will be really hard, and the truths we share are the ugliest of humanity. We don't intend to make it seem like it's all fine or to pretty up the pain, but we also know that the joy we found is all the more profound because of the pain.
So we hope you can stick with us through the ugly, because there will also be joy and hope and humor. Welcome to The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door.
Hi, welcome back to our podcast, The Ugly Truth About the Girl Next Door. I'm Kate.
And I'm Lori.
I feel like, you know, it's been a year and now we have like officially decided that that's like what we do. We introduce ourselves. That's like our thing.
Even though we think we shouldn't.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
So, I also feel like this should be, we might want to cut this, but like, are we in season two now? Is that what, like?
We really have to figure that out, don't we?
Yeah.
I know.
So maybe welcome to season two.
Well, that's right, because it's
been a year. Right. So anyway, we might want to cut all of that, but that's where we're at. So today, though, we're talking about the women. So like a few weeks ago, maybe a month ago, we put on our social medias, ask us some questions. What are some things that you want to hear us talk about that maybe we haven't covered or that we've covered and maybe you'd like to hear more about? It's a bold question to put out there because, you know, obviously, I think sometimes this is a little bit like a train wreck and people want more information, more details that is really not something that I'm, you know, going to share with the world at large, right? But we did get some really good things back from that. We got some people that asked some questions that are super valid, super legitimate, and so we're going to kind of work our way through those. So starting with, a lot of people have asked about the women. So the women being the wives of the offenders, and also more specifically, my mother, and where she falls into this, how she was involved, if she was involved, and all of that. So
that's a big question, because that's a really hard truth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a hard truth for people to accept. I mean, the whole thing is hard for people to get their head around that anybody would be capable of this. But we do have this image of what a mother is supposed to be. And it certainly does not include this.
Right. No, absolutely. It's also just, it's a tough one to talk about just because there's such a push-pull kind of feeling for me. So it's emotional for sure.
What's the push-pull?
You know, I mean, just that feeling of, I mean, you've said it all the time, right? Kids are just born with, of loving their parents, regardless of whether or not they are good or horrible or whatever. And I think, especially their mother, right? Like, I feel like it's a bond that is just there. And it's just emotional. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of great words for it. It's just a very, it's hard to talk about. So, but deep breath. Starting at the beginning, so my parents, along with a lot of the offenders and their spouses, they all grew up together at Bible Presbyterian Church on Grand Island, which we've talked about ad nauseum. My mom was actually born during a crisis. So her father, my grandfather on my mom's side, was an alcoholic. He had driven drunk. My grandmother was pregnant with my mom. He was driving drunk, and he got into a massive car accident. The car accident put my grandmother into a coma. My mother was still alive and well, you know, in my grandmother's womb, and my grandma was in a coma. So months passed. She remained unconscious. My mom's still growing. And finally, it was time for my mom to be born. And like literally the doctors delivered my mom while my grandma was in a coma, which is pretty crazy because my mom was born in the 50s. And mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
that's quite a feat.
Yeah. The fact that they had the technology and the, you know, the know-how, I guess, to deliver a baby with mom in a coma is a pretty pretty crazy thing, I think. But thankfully, my grandmother did awaken after several months. I'm not exactly sure the details of that. It's not really something that we ever talked much about. Like, it was, again, just kind of this, like, unspoken. Like, everybody knew that my mom was born when my grandma was in a coma. But, like, the details surrounding it, I've heard a couple different versions of. but high level, you know, she did wake up. My mom was a baby still when that happened. It was, you know, a few months after she was born that she did wake up. So, you know, kind of following that crisis, my grandfather continued to drink. You'd think that that would be kind of the...
Your wake-up call.
Right. Like, hello, my wife just delivered a baby while she was in a coma because I was driving drunk. And back then, let's, you know, be honest, the laws for drunk driving were not what they are today. I mean, today he would have been in jail for the rest of his life. Maybe. Yeah. Who knows, right?
Yeah, not always.
But definitely some legal consequences there. And back then, that just wasn't... It wasn't a thing, I don't think. Again, that's kind of the story that I've been told, is that it wasn't the same as it is now. So feel free to disagree on those laws back then, but that's what I understand of it. But so he continued to drink. Their home was not peaceful. You know, my grandmother was basically an abused woman herself. My grandfather was unpredictable. He was a force to be reckoned with. He was verbally abusive. I think borderline, maybe physically abusive, definitely with my grandmother. I'm not sure really with my mom or her siblings.
Is that how you remember them?
No. So that's the interesting thing. So I want to just be really, really clear. The grandparents who trafficked me and abused me are my dad's parents. These people that I'm now talking about are my mom's parents. And by the time I was born, my mom's father had gotten sober. So the grandparents that I remember on my mom's side were actually my good grandparents. They babysat us, you know, a lot. They lived around the corner from us, and they were, you know, I mean, my grandma was a broken woman. She was, she had a lot of brain damage from the accident. She also had dementia and, you know, like early stages of Alzheimer's. And so she was very forgetful. She wasn't cognitively intact, really. So my entire childhood, I remember her just being not super with it. You know, like, she wasn't someone that was going to be able to help me. She couldn't really even help herself. But she was a safe space, just in that their house was safe. No, abuse didn't happen to me in their house. Their abuse didn't happen to me at their hands, right? They were my good grandparents. They were the ones that they would take us on these crazy, like, like car rides to the Alabama swamps to see the geese, you know. They would take us on picnics. My grandfather would, you know, take us out in the woods in the snow and build a fire. And, like, literally in the woods in the snow, building a fire. Yeah. So, yeah, they were safe people for me. Again, not people that really could rescue me. I don't know. And maybe they had some awareness of what was going on, but they were just not people that were, you know, cognitively capable of that. But when my mom was a kid, my grandfather was still drinking. He was pretty unpredictable. They had a very rocky relationship. Even when I was a kid, my mom had a rocky relationship with, especially my grandfather. I just didn't see him that way, I guess. Like I said, nobody in my family really talked too much about this whole past part of him. It was like this unspoken knowledge. No one could ask questions. You didn't, you know, that was just like not a thing. But there was definitely a lot of obvious trauma. So fast forward, my mother and my father met at Bible Presbyterian Church. My mom was 15. He was 19.
Obviously, do the math. Not okay.
Yeah. So nowadays that would be considered, you know, statutory rape. That's not a good thing. Yeah. They wrote love letters to each other as, my father actually went away to Shelton College in Florida, which I think no longer exists actually.
Correct. Last I checked. Yep.
Yep. But he was only there for a year. He ultimately returned and then went into business with my grandfather. they both attended the youth group and they found Christianity all in that small church on Grand Island Bible Presbyterian. They dated for, I think, 4 years. Again, this is my, like, you know,
as you understand, as I understand it, as I remember it.
Right. Like, let's, yeah. And then they got married in the church at Bible Presbyterian. Actually, so Bob Vandermeer, one of the men who paid to abuse me, actually married them. My mom was 19. So basically the way I see it, my father very much rescued my mom, right? There was a lot of abuse and things going on in her home. And my dad was this older, I mean, I think she like bonded to him in that way. Like it was like a trauma bond kind of thing, right?
She saw him as a way out.
Yeah. And
as a relatively stable force in the midst of the chaos.
Right. So I guess I see it as not as giving her a pass on any of what we're about to talk about. But in a way, it didn't matter what he and his family were doing or what she thought about it or if she thought it was okay or if she thought it was right. Ultimately, he was like her savior, right? He took her out of a bad situation and he kind of, you know, enveloped her into his family. And that's how that went.
So the difference between an explanation and an excuse. Right. This is not an excuse, but it does give context to the choices that she ultimately made.
Yeah.
And to what extent was she consciously even making choices?
Right.
Or was she just surviving?
Well, and also like layer on top of the fact that Bible Presbyterian Church is literally where she grew up. And it is very much a cult like environment in that, you know, there are practices and beliefs that are layered on layered on layer into people both back then and current day. And so she was already buying into all of that. And then my dad kind of saved her out of, you know, the situation. And my grandparents, my mom's parents were not church going people. They were not religious in any way. They were later in life a little bit more, but, definitely not then. And so again, she's hearing all these narratives. She's getting the layers upon layers of cult-like thinking, mentality, right?
Well, that whole idea of, you know, a male-dominated, male authority, yes. You know, women are subservient and just do what they're told, basically.
Exactly, yeah. So I think it was kind of the perfect storm, right? I mean, again, not an excuse, an explanation, right? It was a perfect storm of setting up for now we have children and then this is what's going to happen to your daughter. She's also very... You know, nowadays, now in 2023 and, you know, even before this, she's very self-involved. She's always been more concerned about the public perception than what was actually going on. You know, my brother and I and our families were very much a photo op for her. It was all about, she didn't actually want to be around my kids. She wanted other people to see her around my kids.
So what do you mean?
So... Yeah, like she wanted to take the picture at the Christmas tree farm every year and be able to post it on Facebook. You know, she wanted to be the perfect mom and the perfect grandma, and she wanted everybody to know that she was that. And it's kind of going back to that whole status thing, right? These people set themselves up in a way in the community in that, you know, it was Mrs. Cook's preschool, right? She was the ultimate preschool teacher. And so then when she retired from that and became a grandma, well, now she's the ultimate grandma, right? Status symbol. So that's kind of just who she is, I guess.
So she wasn't the grandma who was going to be playing Barbies with Evelyn?
Lord,
or
no.
Like,
no, my mother-in-law literally, like, gets on the floor, like, can hardly get off the floor. She will admit that herself. but, yeah, I mean, my mother-in-law and Patrick's aunts, I mean, they will literally be, you know, playing paper dolls with Evelyn for hours on end. My mother-in-law will build a million-piece Lego set for the boys while they play something else, and she's doing, you know, like, that's who she is. She's... And my father-in-law is the same way. He's on the floor. He's playing. He's invested in their actual relationship and their actual lives. My mom, it was about the photo op, right? She, you know, there was no playing. There was no, none of that.
No keeping track of what they were interested in or what their activities were. But they would go to concerts if the kids had an event. If the kids had a public event.
Oh, yes. Yes, for sure. Yep. Especially if it was at the church. If it was at the chapel. My boys went to the chapel's preschool, and Lord, yes, we were at the chapel. They were at the chapel preschool graduation, all the things, want to go on the field trips. Yeah. Again, it's the image, right? It's the image of being the perfect grandparent. So, yeah, it's complicated.
Well, it is a continuation of what we've already talked about, that, like you said, the public perception that was very carefully created did not reflect what was actually going on behind the scenes. So all those people who are listening who had a certain way of understanding your mom and how what they thought your relationship was with her,
right?
That's not really what it was.
Yeah. I mean, and to be honest, like going back to, you know, was she interested in what my kids were interested in? Which again, really was only my boys, because by the time Evelyn was born, all of my boxes were opening and I was starting to panic about the fact that my now daughter was going to be around these people that had, you know, so horribly abused me. So really I'm talking more about my two sons, but she wasn't interested in what they were, you know, becoming, and they were little, but what they were becoming interested in. She was starting to, the grooming process, I believe, of she would have, sorry, it's like hard to even say this because it's like one of those, like, I can't even get my head around what could have happened, I guess. But she was starting to do things like she wanted them to come over once a week for a Bible time, and she would expect me to drop them off at her house, and she would teach them, you know, a lot of, like, she phrased it as she was teaching them, you know, Bible stories and things like that, because we had kind of pulled them out of King's World at the chapel because I was very panicky about strangers and, you know, leaving them with anybody and all of those things. And so she decided to take it upon herself to, and the way that she did that, again, was this very manipulative, if you can do the right things and say the right things, then grandma will give you candy. Mm-hmm. And again, I view that through the lens of my experience, and that the grooming process of going to church, doing the right thing, saying the right thing. If we know the stories, we know the Bible stories, we believe them, then you get candy at the end, you know? Mm. So I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that that's overall, I guess, as a Christian, you can comment, you know, overall, is that a good way of teaching kids those things? But
no, I personally, I don't think so. I understand that that is, you know, there are all these Awana programs that, you know, feed that whole idea. But we want kids. Okay, I know this is not a comfortable subject for you, so I'll quickly say this, but right, we want kids to have a relationship with Jesus, not to be just kind of trying to check the boxes. So mm-hmm. if you're interested in that at all, that's what it's really about, not about let me just prove that I can regurgitate certain verses.
Yeah.
But in the big picture, putting it in the context of your experience and knowing how things like the Bible were used.
Right. It was also that it wasn't interweaved in her interactions with them. Mm-hmm. It was a drop them off so that I can teach them and you go do something else. It was not a you are invited or I'm just going to in conversation mm-hmm. talk to your kids about this or we're going to talk, you know, whatever. It wasn't a comfortable thing. It was like, I've decided I'm going to teach the kids the Bible because you guys aren't. And so every Tuesday, drop them off, and we are going to watch videos and learn verses, and then I'm going to reward them if they can do that. And also, you need to go run errands, Kate. And again, there was a control element there. So mm-hmm. I did. I dropped them off, and I again, it makes me sick to think that I was so controlled in that way still, you know, as a mother myself. But anyways, that, moving on.
But you didn't stay there, and it's really important to recognize. Yeah. You didn't stay in that state, and ultimately you were able to make the changes that needed to be made.
Yeah.
So did she make it something that felt like it was optional for you?
No. Nothing was optional with her.
So how did she get you to agree? Like, If you pushed back, what were some of the kind of responses?
Oh, there was so much guilt, right? There was a guilt tripping. There was a, you know, just this. It was like an unsaid just knowing of control, right? I knew who was in charge. I knew that she had control of me and my life. Could I put those words to it at the time? Probably not. But Patrick could, right? He could see what was going on. He could see that I was unable to say no to her. And that scared me even, right? Mm-hmm. That I felt so uncomfortable about this and could not push back at all. I knew that there would be consequences. There would be guilt trips laid on. There would be, you know, remarks and comments and who knows what else that would happen if I were to do that. So that control, we'll talk about it more, I think, later. But that control piece really remained until there was a no contact situation with her. Mm-hmm. So going back, people ask if my mother knew what was going on, back during the height of the abuse. And the short answer is yes. I have very clear and distinct memories of being in the bathroom at my house. And, you know, I talk about the bathroom a lot. It was kind of the end of the abuse. So, like, if you think about, you know, actually in therapy, we would do like, okay, think about the beginning and then like, okay, mm-hmm. be in the memory and then go to the end, right? Mm-hmm. So the bathroom was the end, right? So we would, at the end of all of it, I would end up in a bathroom usually. So in my house as a child, our only upstairs bathroom had two doors, one connected to the hallway and one connected to my parents' bedroom. So that was just the upstairs bathroom. I would be in there and often, you know, bleeding, crying, very, very injured, obviously. And I have distinct memories of my mom kind of just throwing towels or washcloths at me and telling me to get cleaned up, basically get it together. So I'm, you know, I don't know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and she opens the door and kind of just get it together. She also drove me to some of the places where the abuse occurred. She would take me to these places. I would literally beg her not to leave me there. Don't send me, don't make me go. And she did anyway.
How would she respond to you in those situations?
Annoyed. It was like a pushing me out of the car or like peeling me off of her, like get away from me. Kind of feeling. Yeah. So she would also take me to the doctor. And then lie about the injuries and how they had happened.
Do you remember conversations creating the lie?
Yeah, some of them, not all of them. A lot of times I would listen to what she would say to the doctor so that I knew what I had to then say later. Big things like the horseback riding incident, the non-horseback riding incident, right. But the one that was covered by a horseback riding incident that we talked about with Emily in our last episode, but the one prior, that was a definite, like, we got to get our story straight here. Cause it was so violent. And I mean,
it was your face,
my whole face, right? I broke teeth. I had stitches in my lips. Like it was bad. So, but a lot of times it was just me listening to what she was saying to the doctors and then kind of knowing, okay, that's what we're going to go with. I can't explain, I guess, the knowing of that or of the, like, knowing that that's what I had to do. I just...
Well, you had been brainwashed, programmed, instructed so many times in so many ways that you did not get to have your own voice, that you knew that the only voice that was ever to be heard was them.
Right.
So it just came very naturally.
Yeah. And, I mean, there was a lot of that. Like, that became pretty normal because there was a lot of that. I was like passing out all the time. I had like weird like cardiac issues. I had joint injuries, shoulders, knees. I had, sorry, I don't know, this is hard to say, some near drowning experiences in which the offenders would hold me underwater or hold my face underwater. And so I developed, you know, lung issues where I was, I feel like I'm whining when I say these things. I know.
Oh my gosh. Nobody thinks you're whining.
It feels a certain kind of way, but, I developed issues where I would get pneumonia almost yearly. And a doctor once said in an appointment, like, wow, we see this a lot when there's been like a drowning situation, like scarring on the lungs. And it was just a quick, nope, that's, you know, oh, that's crazy. You know, I don't know.
Right. There's no space for you to say, actually.
Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm going to throw up. I was constantly out of gym class, constantly out of a lot of things. I didn't play sports. She was behind all of that. She was the one writing the notes for that, right? She was writing the notes to school saying why I was absent. She was the one, you know, my dad was the one facilitating and doing the abusing, and my mom was the one covering it up, basically, is, you know.
And sometimes making it possible.
Yeah, and facilitating and driving me places. But so that is the answer to that question. People have asked it a lot as far as did she know? Yeah, she knew. I sometimes have said I don't know to what extent she knew. But when I think through all of the injuries, you know, it's hard to imagine she didn't understand on a level, the extent.
So I can remember early on, like I can remember early on some of our conversations being about how you would emerge from an abuse experience, clearly not okay. And some of the early questions were about, so where was your mom?
Yeah.
And it's very hard for anybody to fathom that she could see you bloody and wounded and terrified and just throw cloths at you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what happened.
I know. There's a little kid part of me still, though, that doesn't want
to
face that.
Well, yeah, because it's terrible.
Yeah. Okay, so some of the other complicit women. Sorry, I have to move on quickly mm-hmm. before I, yep. like, you know. Okay,
don't throw up on my couch.
Right.
Don't do that.
Gross. So not all of the wives of the offenders knew what was going on, or at least it wasn't in my awareness that they did. So they may have or they may not have. But I just, like, as a kid in that moment, I some of them I had clear awareness that they knew what was going on and they were actually involved or complicit. But there were some that I really can't speak to that. So I cannot say they knew because I don't know that they did.
And we know for a fact that some did not.
Oh, yes. Yeah, right. For sure. But they, you know, there were women who were complicit, who would literally get me out of bed during sleepovers, and take me to the abusive husband, to the offender.
So you were sleeping over with your friend.
Yeah.
And
yeah. These were women who had children of similar age to me. Not all of them, right? Emily is a great example. And we talked about that. Like, her parents mm-hmm. were safe people. They were not involved in any way. I did sleep over Emily's house and it was great. We slept in their tent camper thing and it was great. We ate hot fries and pixie sticks. So, oh, which by the way, I had hot fries recently, like kind of recently, and like was like, these are awful. Like, like why? Why were we eating these? I don't know. But anyway, totally random. But no, there were friends of mine whose fathers were offenders, and I would be sleeping over their houses.
By choice?
No. I mean, no, definitely not. I mean, were they my friends? Yes. But were they sort of like a forced friendship? Yes. You know, that sounds awful, but that is kind of just what it is.
So it's not that you didn't enjoy time with the friend, necessarily, some of them
yeah.
more than others, but the sleepover would not have been your first choice.
No, not at all, because their father was an offender, someone who was hurting me. So no, I definitely was never wanting to sleep over. But I would, and then the wife would come and get me out of bed and literally take me to a place in their house, and they would, you know, the husband would abuse me. Yeah, there was also situations where I was supposed to babysit for an offender's kids that were younger than me. Although when I think about like this specific offender, his kids were not that much younger than me. So the reality of like, I'm going to go babysit these, it's just kind of bizarre now, but that was the, you know, again, I understood what was really going to happen, but the guys was, oh, Kate's going to go and babysit for this family. I would show up to the house and the wife would take the other kids, take all the kids and leave the house and basically say to me, you know, my husband, I'm not going to name his name, but my husband is upstairs waiting for you, and she would leave with the kids. That was that situation too, where a wife was 1,000%, you know, involved and complicit and facilitating the abuse being able to happen.
Also currently running around town telling everybody not to listen and all the things.
Yeah. So that there was many wives, many women who were kind of helping my parents spread the narrative about me, right? She's dramatic. She's got mental health problems. She's all the things. Which, by the way, the mental health problems, where are the therapy notes from that, right? Like, if your daughter has such insane mental health problems that she is capable of this kind of delusion, why are there not, like, hospitalizations and such? And there wasn't. So, anyways, that's even happening now, though, with the wives running around kind of fueling this narrative that my parents want out there in the public, right? There's this if you're watching some of the people that we've named publicly, if you watch their wives carefully, that's literally what they're doing. They're spinning their wheels. They're trying to put the spin on at the narrative. They're spreading the lies, spreading the rumors. They're changing their names on Facebook. Some of them have gone on the offense. Women whose husbands we haven't named publicly, but they just, like, know that that might be coming, have actually already, like, changed their name on Facebook and already kind of are out there, you know, just shooting those lies in any direction that it will go. So it's been interesting to watch. Interesting is not the right word, but you know what I mean.
It's telling.
It's telling. It's very telling, you know. It's very, very telling.
So pay attention, folks, to how some of these women are behaving. There's clues.
Yeah. Some of the women were present at the church during the times when the abuse happened. Again, some of them had no idea. Talk about Emily's parents. They had no idea. Her dad was not involved. But some of the wives were complicit, and they did know what was going on in another part of the building. So that's, I think, an important... I think talking about the wives is important because it, again, speaks to the point of how could all of this be going on and, like, nobody know about it? Well, it's not that nobody knew about it. A lot of people knew about it, but the people that they kept it close. They played it very, very close, and they made it so that the people that might actually get help for me or might actually do something right didn't know about it.
I think I have always thought that, we're aware that there are many women who have come to you later to say, I am so sorry because I saw that something was not quite right and I didn't pursue it. I didn't follow up with it. I let myself buy the narrative because I've always thought, okay, so if abuse, this terrible stuff was happening in the church and then what, the puppet practice is done and there are all these wives and moms around, there's no way you were that good of a faker to act like everything was fine.
But again, my parents positioned themselves in a status place in the community and especially in the church in that, okay, so an adult who was a woman back then said to me recently, she asked about the horseback riding incident, and she said, I knew about that. I saw that. I saw the injuries. I questioned it in my mind because I understood that that was unlikely from a horseback riding incident, just given the circumstances and given the injuries. But she said, yeah, but then your mom told me that that's what happened. And I trusted she didn't have any reason not to because of how they positioned themselves in the church and in the community. People just didn't question it because that was the narrative, right? And that is the power of people doing that, of being in a position of authority and being in a position of status, and just they can say whatever they want. And people are like, oh, well, Wendy Cook said it, so it must be true, you know?
And it's so much more comfortable for people to believe.
Oh, yeah.
Than the very uncomfortable truth.
Right. Right. Another question that people have asked is what my relationship to my mother was as an adult, which we did kind of really cover in the beginning, but I guess just to recap, after I got married and the situation had kind of changed, I did that whole kind of put it in a box, forgive and forget, never to be spoken about again. You know, and I think when I was able to do this, when church me kind of took over and I was able to be, you know, that new, you know, front-facing person without all of that, my mom liked me because, again, I was a status symbol for her, right? I became kind of her success. Like, she had this, she was, you know, cursed with this horrible daughter with all these mental health problems and who just was terrible and dramatic. But thanks to her amazing parenting and, you know, how she taught the, you know, the beliefs of the church to me and all of that, like, look at what she created was basically how it felt.
Well, and you've talked about how that narrative was used in church. Like, you weren't allowed to talk about your abuse, but you were allowed to talk about how forgiveness made everything all better.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, because I'm a human being, I longed for that. I longed for her to see me, to love me. And she finally did. I got married and it was like, she finally liked me. And so I fed into this. I let her like me. I let her favor me because it was really the first time in my life that I ever had, that I ever even had that, that I, you know, ever.
And that has to resonate with a lot of people. I mean, to finally be in a position where you've got the love and affirmation from someone that you longed for is very, it can entrap you.
Yeah. So people from the outside would say and would see that we were close. But it was a very, it was a facade, really. It was a closeness that was not close. I had to be very careful, and I knew that. Like, again, consciously, would I have said that at the time? No. I'm pretty sure I walked into your office the first day and was like, my mom and I are super close.
Actually, I don't think we really even talked much about her in the beginning.
Because it was this really, it was unstable. It was very, I had to be very careful. I remember, I know that any time the word abuse or especially sexual abuse was said or came up, if it was on the radio, if it was on a TV show we were watching together, anything, my whole body would go numb. Like, if I heard her hear those terms, my whole body would go numb. I don't even know how to explain it. It was just this panic response of like, no, don't open that box. Like,
we don't talk about these things.
Yeah. And so like, I'm not even talking about it. Someone else on TV is talking about it, but the word was such a trigger that literally my entire self would just like have this panic response. Mm-hmm. She started counseling women at the chapel when I was like in college, maybe. Again, don't quote me on the timing of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure, but it was in my adult years. I was definitely in college and later. She started taking counseling classes at the chapel and then doing this lay counseling, which, by the way, if you have actual trauma, do not see a lay counselor or a biblical counselor. Find someone with a license. Anyways.
Thank you for the PSA.
Yeah, you're welcome. Lori has a license, by the way. So she started counseling women at the chapel, and specifically, oddly enough, women who had been sexually abused. Literally, she used my story, my public story of my daughter was sexually abused by my brother-in-law, you know, blah, blah, blah. The public story that was allowed to be out there is the narrative. She used that to then gain access to women who had been sexually abused. Like, I'm the expert because my daughter was sexually abused, and now look at her. She created this, you know, this beautiful, you know, independent woman, which was not true, right? She created Church Me, right? And so look at how amazing that is. And
I can do that for you too.
I'm doing all kinds of hand motions right now, again, that nobody can see. And it's so upsetting.
They are great, though.
With podcasting. No, but so she used that to then become this, again, this icon, this figure, this status symbol in the church at the chapel of, you know, she is the female counselor that David Drake sends all of the sexual abuse victims to because she has this personal experience, which, by the way, was not even her personal experience.
Right.
But anyways, she would tell me all kinds of details about the things that these women were working through in their counseling sessions with her. So, again, PSA, major, major HIPAA violation, right? So many confidentiality breach, all the things right here.
And just any kind of moral code.
Oh, my God, right? Like, oh, my goodness. But, I mean, I literally knew things about women that she was counseling, knew their names, knew who they were in the church, knew what that was going on in their lives, knew about like medical stuff that was going on with them. I mean, literally, she would tell me all of the things about these women that she was counseling, many of which she would say she didn't believe them. She would tell me that what they had told her and then say, but that's, you know, we both know that that's not true, that they're lying. You know, they need the Bible. They need forgiveness. They need to come clean and repent because they're lying about these things.
Which is reprehensible, even if she actually really believed that. Like, to say that kind of thing to your daughter who was sexually abused, like,
but see,
is disgusting.
That's the caveat, right? Is that it was like a subtle reminder, mm-hmm. like, remember though, like, nobody believes this, right? Like, I am an esteemed biblical counselor at the chapel, and I don't believe this, and nobody's going to believe you either. It was literally that way. Again, could I have put a conscious word to that at the time? I don't know, but that's how it felt, right? Mm-hmm. It was that whole numbing feeling of, why are you talking to me about this? Like, right. And then to realize this is why you're talking to me about this.
It was the reminder that she got to say whether or not someone's disclosure was true or not.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, again, we talked about this. She was super controlling. She kept the narrative very close. I was her success. That was her status. Patrick remembers every single day I would talk to her in the morning every day. Do you talk to your daughter every day?
Sure don't. She would find that so annoying.
She'd be like, okay, I'm literally hanging up on you now.
Yeah, she's spicy.
Love her. No, Patrick remembers every single day, like clockwork. I mean, you could literally set a clock by it. My mother would call me, and my entire day, especially when I wasn't working in those like stay-at-home mom years, I would bend my entire day around her. So like, whatever she was doing that day, she needed to tell me what she was doing, find out what I was doing, and then, like, if we were going to run errands together, like, the whole day be bent around her. And I couldn't do, and I also couldn't make decisions. We, as a married couple, couldn't make decisions without their blessing. I mean, literally, like, house repairs and it was always under the guise of, like, well, Dad knows these things, right? And he does these things. He works on cars, and so he knows everything. And so it was like, I'm going to buy a new computer. Well, you should run that by Dad, you know? It was literally like we, as a married couple, couldn't make decisions without running it past them. Patrick was just absolutely, like, driven insane by this, obviously. I mean, he kind of is the type of person to just be like, whatever. But, like, he couldn't stand
it. It was
this.
Extreme.
Like, this was, like, extreme, yeah. Even into my adulthood, she protected my father. She would run interference for him. Even just, like, little things. Like, you know, well, Dad is so tired. You know, we can't. You know, my brother would ask them to babysit his kids. And my brother and I would talk about this. Like, can you babysit the kids, you know, whatever. Leslie has a doctor's appointment and I need to go with her because there's really serious stuff going on. And it would be like, well, I have to check with Dad. He's so tired. He worked a long day today, you know? And it's like, okay. She was always, always running interference for him, always having to check with him before she made any kind of move. So I would have to check with her before I made any move and she would have to check with him. It was this really strange domino situation. So yeah, it was just, it continued all the way through.
It continued all the way. I'm thinking about the meeting in 2019 where we tried to address some of the concerns. The response the day after was, you owe your father an apology for upsetting him.
Yep. Yep. And the response was calling me, laying on the guilt, calling, crying. I can't believe that you would do that to us. I can't believe you've been in therapy for 2 years and you didn't tell us. I can't believe. all about us, right? Mm-hmm. You owe us an apology for
all
bringing this up. I'm really thankful that you are working through, you know, the past. I'm really none of that. We are so hurt. We are so broken. We cannot believe that you did this to us. And honestly, after that November 2019 meeting, shortly thereafter is when we went completely no contact. And
the dynamics were so clearly on display. All these things that we're talking about how self-involved and how the gaslighting, the guilt tripping, all of that stuff was glaringly on display in this meeting and in the weeks and months following and their response. It was just very clear that, of course, all the things that you had said and that your brother had said, like, it's really important to recognize your brother has corroborated all of these dynamics.
Yeah.
It was just so very, very obvious.
Yeah. And just to even watch and feel the, like, will never forget sitting in that room. And the minute they walked in, I felt like I was 12, right? I felt my whole self just shrink into a 12-year-old. And I watched my brother do the same thing. Mm-hmm. I literally watched him go from being, you know, the executive pastor at the chapel and we're going to do this meeting and, you know, restoration and all the things, and literally sit in that meeting and
Silent. Watch
it unfold, and he shrinks into a little kid too. I watched him do that, and it was like, oh my goodness, like, we're screwed here because, like, this is just the effect that they have on us. This is the reality of our lives. And
I know you had so much anxiety going into that about whether or not I was going to actually be able to hold.
Yeah. Yeah, because for so many years they had been able to convince people like you, I mean, not like you, but people who were in a position to potentially help. They had gaslighted, they had snowed, they had literally done everything that they did in that meeting, and it had worked. Mm-hmm. And so I was terrified that, like, I guess we'll have this meeting, but I guess this is also the end of me and you. I guess this is the end of my therapy with you, because this is going to be how this goes. They're going to suck me right back into where I was. And that's just, and, you know, and all the worst case scenarios of, if I lose this with you, if I lose this relationship and this therapeutic space and all of that, then Evelyn's in danger too. It's not just me, it's Evelyn, right? Mm. And what is going to happen? Because they are going to just suck me right back in, because that is what they do.
And that was 2 years into therapy.
Yeah, 2 years. Yeah. Yep. And this meeting was only scratching the surface. This meeting was just, hey, you are controlling and manipulative, and also, like, barely even talking about any of the abuse, but just kind of, like, high leveling. Like, do you remember that one thing that, right? And the explosion of that was, I mean, catastrophic. So I guess, yeah, lastly, just the impact of growing up with a mom like this and now having no contact. I don't know. I mean, it made me feel very alone back then, because I really didn't have anybody. Any teacher or youth leader or female adult who tried to get involved or tried to reach out or tried to intervene, I guess, was stonewalled quickly. Like I said, you know, just the gaslighting and they would just be snowed. And they would leave. And so I would go through people like that, you know, trying to get help, and it never really came, because they would just go away. Her being complicit made me feel like it was my fault. It had to be, because if my own mother thinks these things about me and she feeds the narrative and she complies with what's going on as my mother, then it must be me, right? Nobody's mother does that unless this is the truth, right? So it made me very trapped as well.
There's this, I don't know if it's a purely culturally American thing, but there is definitely this very primitive sense of mother as a nurturing figure, someone who we expect or assume that if there's going to be anyone in the world who's going to love you well, it's going to be your mom. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when it doesn't go that way, there is a wound that is deep and wide. And I see it so much in the adoptive kids that I've seen over the years that it's bad enough if a father abandons the family. There is a safety issue that mostly comes up with that. But when the mother is the person who abandons the child, whether because they literally leave or they abandon the child by abusing them, there is this sense of there's got to be something very wrong with me because it's got to be me.
Yeah, moms don't leave mother. Their kids. Right. My own mother thinks this.
Right.
Now with, what, 3.5 years?
Since then, you
of
mean?
Of no contact.
Oh, yeah.
Now it feels like freedom, you know, because of the continued control and because of all of the healing and processing and all the things and understanding her role in this and all of that. There's obviously like freedom in just having no contact with either of them, but also with her. And full disclosure, there's also a lot of grief. There's feelings like I never even really had a mom. There's a hole that, you know, I have a lot of people. I tell my kids all the time, you know, especially my boys, they lost their grandparents and all of this too. They did know my parents. Like I said, I'd
more than
you know.
Evelyn. Yeah.
And so there's this hole, but I tell my kids, you know, we have a lot of people that love us very well. They have another set of grandparents that are over the moon, right? They're just great. They have great aunts and uncles, my husband's aunts and uncles, who love on them in incredible ways. And so they have, I'm not saying that they don't still feel that hole, but I tell them a lot. We have a lot of people that love us very, very well. And that is true for me. It just is different. You know, again, I have my mother-in-law, I have Patrick's aunts, I have people in my life who fill that, as much as they possibly can, but there is still grief in that. In just knowing that that's never going to be really completely filled. So it's complicated.
It is.
And I think I think that's the reason we haven't really talked too much about this until now is because it's complicated, because it was like putting words to feelings that are really big. So anyway,
okay.
That's the women.
That's the women.
Yeah, stay tuned. We are going to kind of work our way through these, like this Q&A. We did a Q&A episode a while ago. Mm-hmm. I don't know that we'll do like one episode like that again, but I think we'll just kind of take the things that people have sent us and do some different things with that. So, yeah, thanks for listening.
Stay tuned. If you or someone you know is stuck in a trafficking situation and needs help, please reach out to the National Human Trafficking Hotline by calling 1-888-373-7888 or text HELP, H-E-L-P, to 233-733.